Bonjour. Ah, I see some people replying in French. Some people freeze. Don't worry, it's not going to be in French. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be present at this year's Boston Book Festival. And by the way, I'm Fabien Fieschi, the Consul General of France here in Boston, to attend this intellectual feast that delights Boston every October. I am especially happy to note this year the expanded collaboration between the French Consulate in Boston, the French Cultural Center, and the Boston Book Festival. In partnership, we have facilitated the visit of four remarkable French authors: Marc Crépon, a philosopher and historian; Jean-Claude Redonnet, a specialist of Francophone culture in the United States; Hervé Tisse, a chemist who brought a revolution to our approach of cooking; and Stanislas Dehaene, a world-renowned cognitive neuroscientist and psychologist. Mr. Crépon, Mr. Redonnet, and Mr. Tisse gave a series of passionate discussions on their works over the course of this morning. And this afternoon, the event, State of Mind, Consciousness and Thinking, will consist of a discussion between Stanislas Dehaene and Daniel Dennett, with a world-renowned philosopher and cognitive scientist, and Deborah Becker from WBUR and author of a series on the brain, who has kindly accepted to moderate this discussion for us. In order to briefly introduce to the American public Professor Dehaene, he is a pioneer in the field of numerical recognition. He started his journey with mathematics and computer science before turning to neurosciences and experimental psychology. Beyond leading a laboratory in France's National Institute for Health and Medical Research, INSERM, he is a professor at one of France's most prestigious institutions, the Collège de France. In his latest book, Consciousness and the Brain, Deciphering How the Brain Codes Our Thoughts, Professor Dehaene discusses his team's more than two decades of work on conscious access to perceptions, the human perception of consciousness, and the mind's ability to understand its own existence. Using scientific tools, his team of researchers has tried to turn an age-old philosophical conundrum into an experimental question. This book has already received both a starred review from Booklist and praise from the Washington Post and Scientific American Mind. We would like to thank the Boston Book Festival, in particular its executive director, Debbie Porter, and also its coordinators and volunteers for all their hard work and effort in organizing this sensational event. And finally, I would say that we look forward to use our brain for consciously exploring the many options around Copley Square this weekend that the Boston Book Festival is bringing to us. So thank you to our speakers, and thank you for your attention, and merci beaucoup.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, good, good. Welcome. It's so good to see so many of you here today at the tail end of the book festival. So we've got a big topic, big questions, questions that people have been asking for hundreds of years and researchers have been trying to figure out. What is human consciousness? What is thinking? How do we measure it? How do we know? How do we know we're thinking about thinking? All kinds of interesting questions, and we've got two of the world's leading researchers on this to talk about it, and luckily they agree with each other. So this is not going to be a debate. They're going to each present their books for about 15 minutes, and after that we'll chat a little bit, and then we'll open it up for questions from you. So I'm going to start by having Professor Dehaene give you a little bit of a presentation about his book, and it's fascinating. It's about consciousness and measuring consciousness. He's come up with some of the latest ways that neuroscience can actually measure human consciousness, and he's going to tell you about that first. So I'm going to let him do that.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for being here on a beautiful Saturday afternoon. And thanks to the Consulate and to the Boston Book Festival. The topic today, of course, is a huge one. Is science legitimate to address the problem of consciousness, or is this a bridge too far? Is consciousness beyond the reach of science? When you are among neuroscientists, my fellow colleagues often think that consciousness is the holy grail, something you do after retirement maybe, but not when you are my age. There are of course several objections to there being a science of consciousness. The question of course is whether neuroscience is limited to objective events at the brain level, whereas subjective experience, therefore, should escape scientific investigation. And there is a very big difficulty also in this field, which is that we all have dualist intuitions. It's not just due to philosophers. It's not just due also to religious systems or to legal systems that make us feel there's something very different to free will. It's a very basic intuition that we all have that, for instance, our mind is special, that our mind flies away in dreams, as was already painting in the Lascaux cave 18,000 years ago, the idea that when a person is dreaming, the mind flies away as a bird, and which has been painted so many times and represented in so many cultures. We all have this intuition the mind is special, and it's very hard to see how it could be attached to the body. We blame this idea to some extent on René Descartes, but because I am French, I would like to defend René Descartes. There's been a lot of Descartes bashing these days with Descartes' errors and so on. I'd like to submit that Descartes was actually one of the pioneers of the science of the brain and mind. And if you read Descartes, as I did, you will see that he was really a materialist, was trying to explain a lot about the brain in terms of a machine. Respiration, waking, sleeping, the reception of light, sound, odors, retention of memory, external movements follow in this machine simply from the disposition of its organs, as wholly naturally as the movements of a clock or other automaton follow from the disposition of its cancer weights and wheels. So Descartes tried to be a materialist. He tried to explain vision, action, memory, even wakefulness and sleep in terms of the machine. But he had to appeal to dualism because he was honest, and he couldn't see how this machine could do flexible speech production, could have flexible behavior, the sorts of things that precisely, as we will see, we attach today to the higher levels of consciousness. But I think cognitive science is beginning now to be able to address this issue. So what's new since Descartes? Well, for one thing, I think one of the key ingredients to the science of consciousness that I am trying to expose in this book, Consciousness and the Brain, is the notion of minimal experimental paradigms. We are able to play with consciousness in the lab. And here are some of the paradigms, masking, binocular rivalry, attentional blink, that can all be used to make pictures disappear from your consciousness at will and reappear, so that consciousness can be turned on and off, and we can measure the consequences at the brain level. I'd like to try a little demonstration for you. I hope this will work. So I'm switching to this software, which is actually the one that we are using in the lab, last week, and it will come in a second. You will see a fixation cross that you have to look at. Here it comes. And then on the periphery, I will flash a digit very briefly, but you'll see it. And then there will be a delay, and then there will be letters. And this is the exact disposition we used in the lab. So if there is a long delay between the digit and the letters, I hope you can see this digit very quickly, very clearly. Although it's brief, like it's 4 here, or 6, I hope you can all see it. But now we make the delay shorter and shorter between the digits and the masks. And at some point it'll be so short that the phenomenon of masking will appear, and I hope it's the case now, that I swear to you, I didn't cheat, the digit is still present there. It's appearing in your retina. It's what's called a subliminal image. Don't sue me, you're all being submitted subliminal images. But that's exactly how we can play with this. You know, sometimes a digit will appear in your consciousness. Some of you may say, oh, I just saw it, but most of you don't, okay? So, just a second. I just need to go back to this. Here we go. So, here are actually the two other ingredients that we use in the lab. One is focusing on very simple things. That's what we call conscious access here. The ability to perceive or not perceive an image. We are constantly bombarded by images all around us in this room, for instance. There's plenty of stimuli, but only one of them at a given moment makes it into our consciousness. This is a very simple meaning of consciousness. We may start with something simple, this problem of conscious perception, and later on build up towards the bigger problems of self-consciousness or attention or vigilance. So that was essentially Francis Crick's big idea. Let's start with perception as a model for consciousness. The third important ingredient is quantifying introspection. In this paradigm that I just show you, I can ask you on every trial, did you see the digit or did you not see it? If you see it, you can click a button. If you don't see it, you can click another button. So we can sort the very same stimuli as a function of subjective experience. This is, I think, something rather new for experimental psychology, the idea that subjective perception counts, not because it gives us access to the mind directly. You cannot introspect about how your mind works, but you can introspect about your experience, and this is, in fact, the defining feature of experience that we will correlate with brain activity. So we sort our trials as a function of subjective experience. Now, with all these ingredients, all we have to do, and of course that's a big all, is we can measure brain activity. And you all know this has been a revolution in neuroscience. We can now measure brain activity thanks to functional magnetic resonance imaging. We can measure it through electroencephalography, magnetoencephalography. We can measure the small currents that are generated in the cortex when we think. We can also even use intracranial electrodes in some patients, epilepsy patients, that have electrodes inserted deep in the brains for clinical purposes. We can use these recordings to ask about consciousness. And finally, we can even use these recordings in my little nephew, for instance, on the left, to ask whether he's conscious or not. And of course, there is a big clinical problem. Can we use these recordings to ask whether a patient who is recovering from coma is already conscious or not? So that's very much what we are doing in the lab right now, correlating conscious or unconscious reports with brain activity. And what did we find? Well, the first thing that we found, and I'm summarizing in one slide a lot of data, it's way too short, but what we found is that unconscious processing is extensive. That digit that you didn't see not only got on your retina, but it got into your visual cortex. It got very deep into your cortex. It was processed all the way to meaning. It was even biasing your responses for a few seconds, even though you didn't see it. Subliminal processing is extremely extensive. For instance, in this slide, we're showing the responses to the amygdala, which is a structure deep in the brain, which is responsive to fear. And if we flash you a word that has a content of fear, such as the word rape, for instance, your amygdala will activate quickly, subconsciously, even if you're not aware that there was any word at all. So there is a lot of subliminal processing in the brain, maybe 90%, 95%, we don't know, but a lot. And the flip side is that something special happens on those conscious trials. This is, again, summarizing a lot of work in my lab, in many other labs in the world. What we have found is that the conscious trials are singled out by what we call an ignition. Something that comes relatively late, after about one third of a second after the picture was on screen, if it is conscious, the brain will switch in a sort of all or none manner to a global state of brain activity where the same information is being represented in multiple regions of the cortex. And this is true whether it's a picture, whether it's a sound, whether it's a word. There is a signature of consciousness in this global ignition. We even see it at the level of single neurons. When we can record single neurons in humans, we see that in the higher levels of the cortex, they will switch on specifically when there is an event of conscious experience and not when the subject says, I couldn't see the picture, I couldn't see the digit. In the book, I'm reviewing this data, and I'm also trying to come up with an explanation for these signatures of consciousness. There are several signatures of consciousness that we see in the lab now. And the explanation takes the form of a framework which we've called the global neuronal hypothesis, global neuronal workspace hypothesis. And I just try to give you the flavor of the idea. It's not so complicated to explain. The idea is broadcasting of information. As I just say, there is a lot of unconscious processing in the brain. There are many specialized systems in the brain for processing faces, for processing words, for processing fear, all sorts of specialized systems. The claim here is that consciousness is a second system which has evolved to share this information. Because the modules don't speak so much to each other, there will be this special system that has evolved to share the information. And the claim is very simple. What we subjectively experience as consciousness is the global availability of information. I'm delighted to speak here in front of Dan Dennett, who is a huge influence for this work, and who speaks about fame in the brain. He will tell us about this in a moment. But this is very much the sort of neural substrate for fame in the brain. Some piece of information makes it into a system of distributed neurons that can share the information in the brain, spread it, so that, for instance, you may speak about it. When you're conscious of information, you can speak about it. And this is the so-called reportability criterion. There is surely an evolved network of neurons that underlies conscious experience. And according to this hypothesis, these are special pyramidal neurons with long distance connections that send their axons crisscrossing throughout the cortex. It's not a localized system, it's a distributed system where many areas speak to each other reciprocally. And there is considerable evidence that such a system has evolved, that it is present in the brain of all primates, and that in humans in particular, it has a special evolution where the neurons are larger, they are better adapted to the propagation of information. They have giant dendrites, the tree of arborescences that allow them to receive messages, and they have also longer axons that spread and diffuse the message. Thanks to this system, we can ask, you know, what does it bring? What sort of computations does it bring you? What is consciousness good for? This is, of course, a hot question in cognitive science, one that we are still pursuing in the lab to this very day. But there are some scientists and even philosophers who have claimed that consciousness is worth nothing. It's a sort of epiphenomenon. It's like the whistle on the steam machine. It's not doing anything. I don't think so. I think this is an evolved system that has a very strong function. It's late. Therefore, it cannot be online, it cannot be used immediately to control your fine gestures, for instance. Reflexes are better for that. But it is very useful to reflect upon the information, to compress the information into a few symbols that you can remember for a long time, and to route this information across a series of stages, what I call the human Turing machine. So we have evidence from the lab that if you are asked to do a series of steps, a sort of mental calculation that requires many steps, then you cannot do this unconsciously. You have to be conscious of the information. There are limits to unconscious processing. The limit is when you need to hold on to the information and when you need to spread the information through multiple brain systems, then presumably you require consciousness. In particular, also, when you monitor your own behavior, which is you look back at what you did in the past and whether it was correct or not, there is a specific system that detects your own errors, which is illustrated here on this slide. It's very interesting, you know, you are in this laboratory task, you're told to click buttons, and sometimes you click the wrong button. You click right instead of clicking left. And immediately, you know that you were wrong. You even try to stop it, but it's too late. You know, your hand did the clicking. And when you do this, you have this mesial frontal system, which generates this hugely negative potential on the top of the head, very easy to measure, and is called technically the error-related negativity, but non-technically, people call it the oh shit effect, which I think is very... good metaphor for what it is. You're trying to capture your behavior. You know you were wrong. This is a second order system, and we've shown in the lab that it requires consciousness. If you're not conscious of the digit, you may make an error, but you don't know that you've made an error. This is the sort of thing consciousness is good for. I'd like to close, because I can only survey very briefly what's in the book, but I'd like to close by saying that in the lab we're very concerned by the practical implications of these advances in understanding what consciousness is. And of course we'd like to understand when consciousness starts and also when it is lost in patients with lesions. So I'll briefly say that we begin to be able to apply this knowledge to infants. We can record brainwaves, for instance, from infants using electroencephalography, and then we can look whether the signatures that we found in human adults are already present in human infants. And we find that, yes, to some extent, they are already present. We find that there is this ignition stage when we flash a face to babies, just like you were flashed a digit earlier, but babies prefer faces to digits, obviously. We flash a face, we ask, do we see the same steps of processing? The answer is yes. We have this very late ignition response in babies, all or none, which suggests that when the face was long enough, they could see it. They have a conscious experience of it, analogous to what we have in human adults. The one property that's different is the slowness of it. It's about 3 times slower in these babies compared to in human adults, which I find very interesting. So presumably babies have consciousness, but they require more time in order to become conscious of a specific property of the external world. I think it fits very well with our experience of babies as being able to generate a slow but definitely conscious reaction to the external world. Much more difficult question to end with is, of course, consciousness in the clinic, a literal life and death matter. Can we decide whether some patients still have consciousness? You know that there have been enormous advances in this field. It's very difficult clinically from just interaction, discussing with a patient to decide whether he's conscious or not. But thanks to brain imaging, you can go inside and ask, do I see the signatures in brain activity itself of a person still being conscious? And here is illustrated the classical work of Adrian Owen using fMRI. He was able to show that one patient that seemed completely vegetative, that is to say supposedly clinically non-conscious, in fact still had high-level states of mental activity. If you asked her, for instance, to imagine visiting her apartment or imagine to play tennis, she was able for 30 seconds to hold in mind this state of brain activity, which corresponded to the exact same pattern of a normal person doing mental imagery of the same kind. So the suggestion was this person is conscious. And in fact, similar patients were even scanned using this as a code. You ask them a question, was your grandfather named Joseph? If you want to say yes, please imagine playing tennis. And by reading the brain activity, when they were imagining playing tennis, they were able to see that the patient wanted to answer yes or wanted to answer no, and that the answer was correct. And therefore, this particular patient was probably conscious if he's able to understand language and generate an intention to respond. I should stress that there are just a few patients of this kind. The majority of vegetative patients presumably are not conscious, but of course it is crucial to understand whether a specific person, maybe only 10 or 20% of these patients, still are conscious. So this is a very practical consequence of this work on consciousness. Here, this is the latest work from the lab. You can see it's from last year, but it is in the book. We are able to use EEG, the electroencephalogram, to derive measures of consciousness by measuring the amount of long-distance communication in the brain, picturing it in false colors here, we can sort out patients that are in vegetative state and non-conscious from those that we think are minimally conscious or healthy subjects. So these signatures of consciousness, the growing science of consciousness, is now entering the clinic in a successful manner. So with this, I think I should close. Of course, there are many other questions, there are many philosophical questions, and I look forward to hearing Dan Dennett talk about these more philosophical aspects of this growing science of consciousness. Thank you for your attention.
And now I think we'll hear a little bit more about the philosophical end of things from Professor Dennett.
Yes, but can you hear me? First, I have to say a bit about Stan's book. When I published a book about consciousness almost 24 years ago, I set out a theory that was very sketchy. And over the years, I've been watching from the sidelines and seeing which parts of it held up. And Stan has gone way beyond the sketch that I had and elaborated themes that are very congenial to me. And I think it's the best book on consciousness I've read in the last 20 years. It's full of detail, very clearly, calmly written, with very well set out explanations of every point in it. It's just this material on every page, and it's bringing me up to date, which is what I wanted to do, so that I could return to the consciousness fray more or less up to date. So I'm delighted to be here with Stan, and he's set the table very nicely for me, because I'm going to talk about tools for thinking. My book is called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. But I'm going to be really talking about tools for thinking. And a former student of mine once said, you can't do much carpentry with your bare hands, and you can't do much thinking with your bare brain. And that's as good as the motto of my work these days. I'm looking at the tools for thinking that we all add to our basic born with equipment, the native bare brains that we're born with, and the role that plays in enhancing our powers, our capacities to understand. And the book, Tools for Intuition Pumps, is a collection of tools. The next book is going to be showing how they evolved and how they fit in the brain. Now, here's a chicken egg puzzle. Do tools evolve and make us smarter? Or do we evolve to become smart enough to make tools? And like most evolutionary chicken egg puzzles, the answer is yes. It goes both ways. In fact, Stan was just talking about the neuroanatomical differences between us and even our closest relatives, chimpanzees. We have these great, long, interconnecting neurons, which are really quite special. What drove their evolution in our brains? I would say what drove that was the advent of human culture and language, which gave the brain a flood of new opportunities, but also a flood of new problems. So I see a co-evolution between cultural evolution and genetic evolution, explaining the tremendous difference between our minds and the minds of really any other animal. Yes, I am pushing the human exceptionalist button, and I am pushing it deliberately, and I am not saying that we are outside the realm of science. I'm going to give a sketch of a scientific account of how our minds are exceptional and why. Now, Some of you know about the Flynn effect. IQ has gone up dramatically in the last century. Why? Well, Flynn thinks it has to do with human culture, and I think he's right. The thing is, words are tools, and once you've got words and you know how to use them, you have increased your competence in many ways. There's lots of different kinds of tools that are, what are they made of? They're not made of wood and steel. They're informational systems. They're structures, they're habits, they're routines that we learn, whether it's long division or alphabetizing a list. There are many. Each of you are equipped with literally hundreds and hundreds of culturally born thinking tools that enhance your capacity to think. And I'm going to add a few to them, to your kit today. And what I call intuition pumps, these are rather elaborate tools. These are thought experiments that extend your imagination. But there are also many intuition pumps which cloud your imagination, and I'm very critical of those. But I want to give you a few good examples. I'm going to start with a very simple tool. It's called the Shirley alarm. I want you in the future, every time you see the word Shirley in a text, I want a little bell to ring. Ding! That little bell alerts you to the fact that the author has just used the word surely, and this is very often, not always, very often the weakest point in the argument. Why? Well, the author is telling you something that you're supposed to accept, but it doesn't go without saying. If it did, he wouldn't have said it. It's got to be said, but the author doesn't want to bother arguing for it, so he nudges and says, surely. That's a very good place to drive a wedge. It doesn't always work, but if you just get in the habit of having that little bell ring when you see the word surely, you'll discover a lot of weaknesses in a lot of arguments, not just in philosophy or science, but in politics. Now, I think we should have a little practice with the Shirley alarm. So suppose you have a cup of coffee and you're going to put milk in it and you want to keep the coffee warm as long as possible. So with the milk in it, so surely you should wait and put the milk in as late as possible, right? I didn't hear any ding. Surely you should ding. Okay, all right. When it comes to the Middle East, if the choice is between stability of government or democracy, well, surely democracy. Thank you. Now, what have I just done? I've just downloaded an app to your necktop. I get letters from people saying, how do I turn the Shirley alarm off? And the point is, no, you leave it there with a host of others. It's a useful friend. It'll get in the way rarely, but you'd be surprised how often it works. Here's one of my favorite slides. On the left, we see a termite castle, an Australian termite castle. On the right, we see Gaudi's great church in Barcelona. Very similar structures, both inside and out. They're very similar. They're both artifacts made by living organisms. They are profoundly different when you think of the research and development, the R&D, and the design and construction. The one on the left, of course, was designed by termites. The one on the right by Gaudi. Oh, I got ahead of myself. Never mind. Can we go back to that previous slide? Thank you. The termites are clueless. There's no boss termite. There's no architect termite. There's a queen termite, but she's not in charge. These are thousands, hundreds of thousands of clueless little operators doing their thing, and they don't even know what they're doing or why. Gaudí, on the other hand, is a paradigmatic, charismatic boss. He's got blueprints and manifestos, and he's got it all worked out in advance. It's a very different sort of top-down design and construction compared with the termite colony. Now, we understand very well nature's way of doing termite-type building. What we need to understand is, how do you get from termite-type design and construction to Gaudí-type design and construction? That's a tall order, particularly because your brain is more like a termite colony than you might at first think. You got billions of neurons, they're each clueless. They don't know Baroque from Rococo. They don't know Barcelona from Cleveland. And yet, you put enough of them together just right, and you get a Gaudí mind, full of comprehension and understanding and vision, seeing ahead, planning ahead. The trick is to see, how can you organize all those neurons to make a Gaudí-type mind? And I think that's one of the reasons that some people say, this is just beyond science to discover. I beg to differ. I think we're making great progress on it. And the answer is, it's in the organization of all of those neurons. Stan and his colleagues in Paris have literally, hundreds of experiments which shed light on how the architecture of the human mind is organized in the human brain, but we still have a long way to go. And I would submit, Stan and his colleagues are working on the bear brain. They have hardly touched on the tool-infested brain of you and me, although they rely on it all the time. Because after all, when you ask a subject to perform a test, when you tell the subject what to do, you're depending on the fact that both you and the subject have language and can comprehend. Basically, when Stan sets up a subject to press the button if you see this and press this button if you see that, creating a little app in that brain which is going to give him evidence about what's going on inside. So now here's the question: how could a Gaudí-like comprehension arise out of this organization of clueless bits? And I think the answer is culture, which relies on cultural evolution, which is not genetic evolution, but is a separate evolutionary process. I want to illustrate the remarkable feature of what I call competence without comprehension. You've all seen the documentaries of the gazelles running away from the cheetahs or the lions and throwing these ridiculous, high, beautiful leaps. It's called stotting. And people wonder, what's this stotting for? It's very energetic, it's dangerous, they're wasting time, it's not helping them get away from the predator. What are they doing? Well, it's pretty well worked out now. Here's what stotting is. It's costly signaling. The gazelle is saying, look at me, I can throw these ridiculous, expensive, athletic leaps. You still can't catch me. Go after my cousin. He can't do this. And the lions believe him. Now, there's the evidence shows that the animals that can stot are seldom predated. It's the ones that aren't strong enough, fast enough to do that expensive activity. They're the ones that get predated. So now look, I've given you the rationale of this. It's a signaling system. It's a communication system between two different species. But here's the important point. The gazelles don't have to understand that. They can be just as clueless as a termite. They don't know why they're starting. They just have an urge to stop when the lion, if they can, when the lion attacks. And the lion doesn't have to understand why it isn't attracted to the starting gazelle. It just doesn't seem very attractive as a prey item. It goes after the ones that aren't starting. Neither the sender nor the receiver has to understand the message for the message to get through. That's a stunning, weird fact. But it's a very important fact because the same thing's true in our brains. Your optic nerve doesn't have to understand what's out there in the world that it's sending information to the visual cortex on. The different parts of your brain, the different collections of neurons, can be quite termite-like and still carry information. Well, now, in the case of starting, what shapes this behavior, what designs this behavior, is genetic evolution. Over the centuries, over the millennia, this communicative behavior has evolved and has been stabilized by the rationale that I mentioned. The same thing has to happen in the brain. In the brain, however, much of the stabilization has to be a case of intracranial evolution. There's no little guys in there that understand. There aren't. They're all quite clueless. But there are evolutionary systems, or quasi-evolutionary systems in the brain, which can shape coalitions of neurons to communicate, discriminate, evaluate, and generate decisions, and none of the individuals have to understand at all, and yet comprehension is the result. Thinking tools, we're the only species that really has thinking tools. And the beautiful thing about them is, in effect, they evolved elsewhere. None of you had to invent long division or language or arithmetic or alphabetizing lists or calculus or any of the other tools that you may have in your kit. There's no other species that can share knowledge like that. You didn't get it from your grandfather and your great-grandfather and your great-grandmother. You got it from people you never met, because it's transmitted by the culture. Analogies are very good thinking tools. I want to give one example. How am I doing for time? Yeah. I'm going to tell you about Vim. There's a big argument in consciousness work about whether conscious states have some intrinsic property which defies science, you know, to the end of time. And I've drawn the analogy with the following amusing scenario. A lot of American tourists, they go to Europe, they're asked, they want to buy something in euros, and they say, how much is that in real money? Meaning dollars. And they say, in effect, I don't know how you folks get by with euros. They don't have any intrinsic value. Dollars have intrinsic value. You can just feel it. I mean, I know what a dollar is worth. It's not as worth as much now, but it's intrinsic. And yes, indeed, you can translate euro value into dollar value, but euros themselves have no actual intrinsic economic value. Only dollars have that. Well, we can all see that that's a mistake, right? I think many philosophers, and not just philosophers, some neuroscientists, make the same mistake about consciousness. They say, well, you're giving us all these functional features of events in the brain, but where's the intrinsic qualia, the vim, of the conscious state. And I think they're making the same mistake. It's just more clouded, you might say, harder to see. The idea is that a property is intrinsic. All right, if I've got time for one more quick thought experiment? No, I don't think I do. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you. Maybe you can bring it up when we're chatting. I do want to mention that we are going to open it up for questions, and there are microphones in the room if you have a question. And afterward, they will be signing copies of their books, and you can talk with them afterward in Gordon Chapel. What I'm wondering, if you can both briefly address this, is what do you think your research and your measurements say about the notion of a human soul in consciousness? Professor Dehaene.
That's very interesting. I was when asked to organize a conference for the Vatican, because I am a member of the Pontifical Academy of the Vatican, I was asked to organize a meeting about the brain, the mind, and the soul. And I said I could find scientists for the first two topics, but not for the third.
So is the notion of a soul not...
We ended up organizing a meeting which was the brain and the human person, which I think was very interesting, actually, because that's exactly what we can deal about. We can deal about the various aspects of the human person, the feelings, the subjectivity, the pain, the social aspects. We had a very nice session on the social brain, which is an issue which is advancing quite a bit. So all of these aspects are being taken apart, basically. I don't think this leaves a lot of room for a separate concept of the soul, basically.
I was asked this question some years ago by a very good Italian science journalist and philosopher, Giulio Giorello. And the next day in Corriere della Sera in Milan, there was an interview article about it. And the headline was wonderful. It's become a sort of talisman for me. It said, "Sì, abbiamo un'anima, ma è fatta di tanti piccoli robot." Yes, we have a soul, but it's made of lots of tiny robots. And that's what I said. I said, there is a structure in the human mind which distinguishes it from other animal minds in that it grounds the competences and the attitudes and the inclinations that make us moral people, that make us worthy of love and capable of being held responsible. Now, that's the role that the soul has typically been given. That role is filled. It's just not filled with a different kind of thing. It's filled with apps that you download to your necktop.
In terms of perception, I, as a journalist, my beat primarily is mental health and criminal justice. Unfortunately, those two things collide quite a bit right now. So when you're measuring consciousness and someone has a very different perception, if you will, than maybe most of us do. For example, if I look at that sign behind us, and to me it says Boston Book Festival, I've interviewed people who have significant differences in thinking, and they might think that sign says the CIA is looking for them, right? So how do you measure those very different types of consciousness or thinking, if you will? And what does the research tell us about that when it comes to mental health issues? Professor Dehaene.
Well, this is a very difficult question. I think we are indeed finding that there are differences in high-level brain organization. You are mentioning hallucinations or paranoia, and it's very true that there are anomalies being discovered in the brain of schizophrenic patients, including, interestingly, at this very high level of consciousness. So we did several experiments in the lab to show that, well, the results showed that unconscious processing was very preserved in these patients. They had no anomalies at the level of unconscious processing, but the process of conscious access was very different. was much slower. It didn't have the same integrative capacity that we found in normal subjects. This is just a fact, and I think there'll be more facts of this kind suggesting that there are indeed pathologies at either the level of the processes themselves or at the level of the integration process, the workspace process. What we do with that as a society is another matter. Prison is the traditional answer, or psychiatry wards. I hope that with the science that we have, we may be able to find new answers, but I cannot presume on what they will be. I just see that there may be new drugs and especially new brain-computer interfaces that may add to our toolkit, as Dan was saying, to be able to maybe prevent or compensate for some of these anomalies.
I think it's a question of which citizens are competent to be held responsible and allowed the freedom of motion and to be allowed to be out in the state. And we've learned a lot about those competences and pathologies of competence, which we have morally have to take into consideration and recognize that some people are not able to govern themselves in the way we would want them to be able to govern themselves, so that we can permit them freedom of movement and freedom of choice in other ways. We have to do something with those people. They are a risk to others and to themselves. What we do, as Stan says, is very much a matter of the state of the art of what we can do. The fact is, there are non-invasive technologies which can make a significant difference. We can identify shortcomings, problem areas in people, and then in effect create eyeglasses for the mind for them in, to some regard, which can then raise them to the level where they can meet the standards for, shall we say, citizenship. A lot of people worry that as we learn more about neuroscience, we'll end up, nobody will be held responsible because we'll understand how everybody's brain works, and it'll all be just, there won't be any room for responsibility. I think that's a very misguided idea. The reason is that what's going to prevent that is, if you like, political. People want to be held responsible because that way they get all the benefits of being out and in free society. That is as long as we keep the benefits for freedom high, we don't have to worry about creeping exculpation, as I've called it. It's not going to happen because people are going to want to be held responsible and they're going to be willing to do what it takes to maintain their integrity and their autonomy in the face of whatever we learn about assaults on that integrity.
Dan, I think you and I share this idea that autonomy and free will are genuine, right, in the brain.
Yep.
They are not going to go away with more reductionist neuroscience. I think that personally that free will is just a property of the network that I was describing, that it generates these autonomous states of matter that self-organize, are filtered according to a Darwinian principle that you described, such that it's okay to describe this machine as having free will. It's not just what we think usually about free will as something non-determined. It is determined by the structure of the machine, but it is genuinely autonomous. We carry it autonomously in our brains. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And what about the structure of the machine? You know, you brought up Gaudi. What about the structure of the machine that makes his machine create the way it does and others not create that way? And can you change the structure or alter the structure, you know, to make someone more Gaudi and artistic and be able to create structures like he did in Barcelona?
I very much doubt that there will be, as it were, routine ways of generating super creativity in the near future. I think there's actually some fairly interesting theoretical reasons why shall we say, groundbreaking creativity is always going to be a few steps ahead of anybody's methods. There's not going to be any algorithm for creativity. Although many things that used to be creative can be sort of routinized. That's something that we learned. But the pioneers are still going to have to be rare individuals who, one way or another, and it may, of course, be because they've been subjected to horrendous experiences in their life. We don't want to foster that. But then again, the people who've been through that, those trials, are often very creative.
Professor Tan, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't think we have a science of super creativity, but we begin to have a science of how the brain changes with education. And I wanted to react actually to what Dan was saying. I think there is a growing science of going beyond the bare brains. How, for instance, education to reading or education to mathematics is changing the brain in a way that not really expands it, but makes it more flexible, makes a better use of the available resources. The idea is that there is a lot of redundancy in the bare brains, if I may take your expression, and by education we learn to diversify what it's doing. We recycle parts of the brain to do letter recognition, whereas it was just doing object and face recognition. We're doing something else with it, something slightly different. And in this way we have more processes, we are more apps in your sense, we have more flexibility in the available routines. I see mathematics very much in this way. A mathematically trained person is one that has at its disposal a lot more options to look at the world, to generate, you know, pictures of the data that it gets, he or she gets. And we begin to have a science of that. We can see literally the difference between a literate brain and an illiterate brain, or the difference between a mathematically trained person or not. This was largely the topic of my previous books, actually, so I didn't talk about this today, but reading in the brain is very much about that.
And what about the role of emotion and what we know about emotion and how it affects consciousness? I mean, you had mentioned when a word is flashed, a word that may create fear, like the word rape, and what happens to various areas of the brain and how you measure it. How does emotion affect consciousness? I think many of us can probably remember something that maybe was traumatic or fearful, and we may forget, right? We may forget that that happened, or we may have a cloudy memory of the details of exactly what happened, because it seems as if our mind almost compensates for that, right? And lets us not remember or not be conscious of some of the details. What do we know about what's going on there in terms of our consciousness and in terms of how we can tell what's going on there?
Let me jump in.
Okay.
Because I want to change your question a little bit. I would say that the big difference between a human brain, any animal brain, and any of the computers we've built so far, is that in a human brain, all control is ultimately by emotion. It is by the modulation and competition and negotiation between different affective states and neuromodulator floods. There's no boss in there. There's no cop that's prioritizing. What does the prioritizing, what lets you concentrate on one thing or distracts you, what thrills you or depresses you, this is what determines what you think about next, not any other sort of master program. So it means that emotion, the idea of the emotionless computer brain is bad science fiction.
So what about the idea of a conscious computer?
Yes, but it's going to have to be one where the control structure is very different from the control structure of the computers of today.
We have just a minute, I think.
I want to say I agree with the conscious computer. I think the emotions are no longer treated in cognitive science as a separate system. It's been discovered that every single of our emotions is an evolved system with a specific computation in mind. So emotion is computation. And each of these neuromodulation systems is there to add a very precise variable to the learning algorithm. A bit of attention, a bit of additional error processing, so on and so forth. And contrary to what Freud said, these systems very often add to the processing of external stimuli such that they enhance our consciousness, not diminish it. So we found, for instance, that these emotional words, they break in to consciousness with a lower threshold. They don't need as much exposure in order to become visible because they're helped by these emotion systems.
Yeah.
All right, great. I'd like to open it up for questions. Ooh, we have a line. Question.
Yes, question. I was fascinating topic. I was intrigued by the example you gave, Stan, about the patient who was asked to answer a question and to think of playing tennis if the answer was yes or no. Very, very intrigued by that. My question is, are we saying that science, we're at a stage where we can read people's thoughts and minds? Did I understand that correctly? And then the second part of my question, how far are we, if we're able to do that, to go the other way, where we can put thoughts in people's mind through, like, the Matrix, you know, the movie The Matrix, something like that?
These are wonderful questions, thank you. Yes, if we believe there is an identity between every thought and every pattern of the brain, we should be able to go both ways, right? And it begins to work. There is, for instance, fascinating new experiments about decoding mental states. We've been able in the lab to decode which number people are thinking and holding in memory by just looking at the pattern of activity in one specific brain area, which relates to number sense in the parietal cortex. Other people have been able to decode by waking up a person while she is being scanned and asking her what she was dreaming about. You can use the pattern of brain activity just before she was awakened to guess better than chance what she was dreaming about. So this is the state-of-the-art science. This is a Nature paper from last year. Should we be worried about this? Well, first of all, it's only above chance. The scientific demonstration is you can do better than chance. It's not that you can read every thought, and this is not at all the case for the moment. Furthermore, it systematically requires the help of the person who is being scanned. She must lay still, she must participate, she must try to amplify these signals by concentrating and so on. So it'll be extremely easy to disrupt this experiment and turn it to nothing if the person was not willing to collaborate. So I don't think we have to worry too much about the negative uses of this possibility, but it's real, and in theory, of course, every thought is a state of the brain.
Yes.
I wonder whether you would speak further on the relationship of self-consciousness to consciousness. Hmm. You alluded to that, and Dr. Dennett, I wonder whether you would speak briefly on the qualifying word quasi, when you corrected yourself from saying evolutionary processes in the brain to quasi-evolutionary processes in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lovely book by Peter Godfrey Smith on Darwinian populations and natural selection, that's the title, where he introduces some very elegant diagrams which lets you see that in addition to the pure cases of natural selection, the sort of parade core cases of natural selection, there are lots of processes which are like natural selection in one or two or maybe three features, but they're not classic cases. The development of the nervous system in the individual brain is very much a matter of generation of lots of extra neurons which compete, and only some of them get to survive and populate the region, and the rest are absorbed and lead to another generation. The very building of a brain is a quasi evolutionary process. Then, once you've built a brain, the learning in the brain is another quasi evolutionary process. Now, there have been no dearth of theories of these evolution in the brain hypotheses over the last 50 years or so. I think it's fair to say it's the only non-miraculous, non-question-begging model we have of how a nervous system can start in one state and improve itself through learning from taking in information from the world. Unless it's got a miraculous demon in there, it's going to have to do it by a quasi-evolutionary process. So there's no shortage of candidate processes for reshaping the structure, the functional structure of parts of our brain, where there's generation of diversity and then some sort of systematic selection which leads to a higher than chance probability of getting things better. It's a constant self-improving phenomenon.
And the relationship of self-consciousness to consciousness?
Oh, good.
And I'd like Professor DeHaan.
Yeah, in the book that I'm working on right now, I talk about these processes and talk about these leading to ever more efficient and effective and, shall we say, foresightful and intentional redesign processes so that we become the intelligent designers of our own nervous systems. And we're the only intelligent designers. And we're not that intelligent. But in fact, we are. If you want to see an example of intelligent design, Gaudi, Turing, these are good examples. And each one of us can become an intelligent redesigner of our own minds. That's very much what self-consciousness is about.
One word about this,
yes,
perhaps?
Go ahead.
Sorry. So what I describe today, conscious access is really level one of consciousness, if one may say, access to external information. Now, level two is access to that information itself. So self-consciousness, a way to represent what you've already represented in the external senses. The growing consensus in cognitive neuroscience is that we're making use of the same networks that allow us to represent other people. We use areas of the so-called social brain network, the lexicon of people that we have in our heads. We use the same areas to represent ourselves as another person. We live, of course, a long time with ourselves, so we have a lot of time to learn about ourselves, but we have to learn about it just like when we observe other people. We just have slightly a bit more information about ourselves, so we learn a bit more, and that would be self-consciousness.
Unfortunately, we have 1 minute, so last question, and we're going to have to be brief.
Okay. I'm wondering what both of you think in terms of consciousness. Does it originate in the brain, or does it filter into the brain?
Good question.
Coming in from some external source, whatever that may be.
As when people say they meditate and they achieve
a... refer to a collective conscious.
Right,
there's
right.
been many different thoughts about what might be out there, but I'm wondering if you think consciousness originates in the brain or comes in from an external source, whatever that may be.
I would challenge the image that you're suggesting. I don't think consciousness is like a substance which comes from outside in or is generated inside. Consciousness isn't that kind of thing at all. Consciousness is a huge set of emotional and cognitive competences that intermesh in all sorts of ways, influenced by external stimuli, external inputs, but also, and Stan is very good on this in the book, a lot of it is endogenously driven. There's a lot of internal, spontaneous generation of activity without which we wouldn't be able to do half of what we do.
I was going to point to the enormous research which has exploded in the 15 past years, showing that the brain is in fact spontaneously activated. It's never quiet. Even if you lie and think you're resting, there is, throughout this workspace system that I was too brief to describe today, there is spontaneous waves of activity that correspond to the flow of thoughts, mind wandering, that constantly occurs in your mind. So this is one way to understand that we're not just automata that are submitted to the external world. We spontaneously carry in ourselves the subjectivity that we project onto the outside world. So I would think that not only it comes from the brain, but even in the absence of external stimuli, the brain is able to carry out a lot of subjective projection onto the outside world.
All right. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank Professor Dehan and Professor Dennett. Keep up the good work on the big question. Thank you very much. Thank you.